Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important battle spaces in that war, which has lately been, well, once again, neglected, or at least inadequately understood, is fortunately the battle space in which our first guest operates and is supremely effective. His name is Robert Spencer, no stranger to these microphones. We're very pleased, as always, to have him. He's a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, I'm proud to say, as well as the director of a truly indispensable online resource, jihadwatch.org, which is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Robert can be found on the pages of Front Page Magazine and PJ Media, and of course in an entire library of books that he has published, including, among others, several for the Center for Security Policy Press. We're always delighted to have him with us. Welcome back, Robert. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
I was particularly anxious to catch up with you today, Robert, because yesterday the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in one of its more egregious examples of superficial and woefully inadequate oversight, rubber-stamped the nomination of a man by the name of Rashad Hussein, with whom both of us are somewhat familiar. We've talked about him in the past on this program, and I wanted to get your take on the fact that essentially the committee, without debate, without really much in the way of a hearing, for that matter, on this nomination, has now sent forward with its unanimous approval the nomination of a man who moderate Muslims, among others of us, are very concerned would not acquit himself well as the ambassador at large for international religious freedom, if the Senate should, in the days ahead, approve this nomination. You've talked about this. I know you've studied his track record a bit. What is the essential problem with a man who the Muslim Brotherhood groups in this country are very keen to see confirmed, actually gets the job?
The core difficulty with Rashad Hussein, Frank, is that he is a Hafiz, which means that he's memorized the entire Quran, and that in itself indicates that he is a devout and believing Muslim. Now, everybody who voted for him in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee would immediately say that my saying that was just a manifestation of Islamophobic bigotry, and that Rashad Hussein's religion has nothing to do with whether he would acquit himself well as the ambassador for religious freedom. However, this overlooks, and as you noted, the analysis, as always, was superficial. This overlooks the fact that Sharia teaches the supremacy of Islam and Muslims over non-Muslims and non-Muslim religions, and teaches that the non-Muslims should be subjugated under the hegemony of Islamic law. That being the case,
Robert, excuse me, just for one second.
Rashad Hussein is confronted with a situation involving Muslims persecuting Christians. He will be torn, if he is indeed a true believer, as he seems to be, between thinking that the Christians are getting their due in being humiliated as a sign of the disfavor of Allah toward them for rejecting Muhammad and the Quran, and between his responsibility to defend the religious freedom of everyone. And this inquiry itself, this possibility, has been completely dismissed as bigoted and Islamophobic, but it is a real possibility. And one day there is going to be a confrontation about it, because whether it's Rashad Hussein or some other Muslim appointee, there's going to be some official at one point or another who rules in favor of his assumptions and beliefs based on Islamic and Islam and Sharia rather than American law. And this is the concern that we have brought to the fore in this regard, but have been completely dismissed by people who don't know anything about Sharia and don't care about it, because they believe that even the inquiry itself is Islamophobic. So this is testimony to the success of groups such as the Hamas-linked Council on American-Islamic Relations and others in stigmatizing even this necessary discussion that we should be having.
Robert, when you say the Quran and Sharia teach that people of faiths other than Islamic adherents are to be treated as inferior, dhimmis, I think is the term in Arabic. What is the nature of that teaching? Is it kind of a one-off statement that can be found somewhere in the text of this book that Rashad Hussein has, as you say, memorized in its entirety, at least so we're told? Or is it a theme that is really endemic in authoritative Islam's teachings, tenets, and practices?
Very much the latter, Frank. There's one particular passage of the Quran that makes it very clear, and that's chapter 9, verse 29, which says that the Muslims must fight against even the people of the book, which is primarily Jews and Christians, until they pay the jizya, which is a tax, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. But as you noted, this is something that runs all the way through the core teachings of Islam, which are summed up also in chapter 48, verse 29 of the Quran. Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. Those who follow him are merciful among themselves, but ruthless to unbelievers. Now, as a corollary of this, there's also Islamic history. And that shows that throughout history, there has never been an Islamic state based on Sharia that has granted fully equality of rights to non-Muslims. And as a matter of fact, every Sharia state throughout history has systematically discriminated against and oppressed the non-Muslims on the basis of Islamic law, Sharia, regarding how they ought to be treated in the Islamic state. And so this is not something that's just some crazy forgotten verse that people have plucked out of, that Islamophobes have plucked out of the Quran and nobody else is paying attention to, comparable to Islamic apologists invoking old passages of the Old Testament that neither Jews nor Christians take literally and saying, see, the Bible is just as violent. It's not like that at all. This is a core element and a core aspect of Islamic law to this day. And so Rashad Hussein, if we had any actual responsible lawmakers, they would have been asking him about this and asking him how he would deal with the contradiction between Sharia and American law, in particular in regard to religious freedom.
Robert, the concern here is not simply that the council of Rashad Hussein inside the senior ranks of not only our diplomatic corps, but of our State Department and indeed the Biden administration will be at best influenced by this doctrine of Sharia. At worst, you know, maybe dictated by it, but certainly influenced at the very minimum. But the other piece of this that's so worrying is that this appointment and what it bespeaks about either the Biden administration's fealty to Islamists and its desire to promote them will signal to fellow Sharia supremacists elsewhere around the world. And it's, of course, against the backdrop of what was already telegraphed horrifically by the appalling performance of this administration in Afghanistan and the emboldening that that has provided to not just the Taliban, but all manner of other Sharia supremacists. But wouldn't this not, in your opinion, Robert, suggest to those who have been championing, you know, the future caliphate, the inevitable triumph of Islam over other religions, the perpetrators of persecution of Christians, Jews, and others, citing, among other things, some of the texts that you've mentioned, that they all will be further empowered and incentivized even to engage in activities that are very much inimical to not just religious freedom for everybody in the world, but for our security here at home as well.
That's right, Frank. It's as if the policeman is off the beat. And the primary state that should be the guardian of religious minorities around the world that are persecuted, that is the United States, is signaling by the appointment of Rashad Hussein that it's going to not take, is likely going to turn a blind eye to the persecution of Jews and Christians under the hegemony of Islamic law. And consequently, that's very likely to embolden the persecutors and make them think that there's nobody really who's going to stand up against them, so they have nothing to restrain them.
This is terrifying, honestly. And the fact that it has moved this far without, you know, appreciable discussion, let alone real debate, is a travesty, in my opinion. And I pray that before this nomination proceeds to approval by the Senate, there will be such a debate. I think it's imperative, Robert, for reasons you've mentioned, among others. And we must, I think, in keeping with the importance of this topic and its implications well beyond, again, the religious freedom portfolio, do everything in our power to stimulate that debate. And we appreciate your help in that regard. Robert, you've also been contributing to a necessary debate that unfortunately did not take place and prevail, at least in the House of Representatives yesterday, I believe, featuring legislation by Ilhan Omar, a member of Congress from Minnesota, who has become quite notorious for her, well, shall we say, Sharia supremacist proclivities. You've written about this at our website, securefreedom.org, and I commend to our listeners this important essay. Talk a little bit, if you would, about what's in this legislation and what it would mean were it to be approved by the Senate and signed into law.
What it calls for is the State Department to establish a special envoy to monitor Islamophobia worldwide. Technically, it's not supposed to be applicable to incidents of so-called Islamophobia within the United States, but it seems likely that once the State Department is bound to monitor such a thing worldwide, that it would extend to domestic incidents of this spurious phenomenon as well. The greatest weakness, or the most insidious aspect, if you will, of the bill is that it does not define Islamophobia. And the term Islamophobia over the last 20 or 30 years has been used in two distinct ways. One is to refer to vigilante attacks on individual Muslims, which are never justified under any circumstance. The other is to refer to honest analysis of the motivating ideology behind jihad terrorism, which unfortunately, whether we like it or not, is rooted in core Islamic doctrine. And that enterprise of inquiry into the motives and goals of the jihadis has been stigmatized by groups such as CARE and others over the last 20 or 30 years as Islamophobia. So the conflation of these two is designed to give the impression that these analyses of the motives of jihadis are giving rise to those vigilante attacks and therefore must be silenced. And so the insidious aspect of the bill in leaving Islamophobia undefined is that it will likely lead to an inhibition of counterterror effort and a genuine silencing of those who are pursuing, trying to understand what is making the jihadis do what they do. And so they will thereby, therefore, have a free hand, as per the ancient adage of war from Sun Tzu, you have to know your enemy. And if we don't know the enemy, we won't be able to counter what he's doing.
I think the history of this era, when it is written, hopefully by people who have the benefit of both perspective and the ability to describe it objectively and not from the vantage point of the victors, who may not be us if we persist in this behavior. I'm Robert Spencer. I'm obviously not talking about you as a remarkable historian writing in the present moment. They will look back at this and say, we have never really, despite your best efforts, my friend, and mine and our Center for Security Policy, among others, to clarify what we're up against. The true nature of these, well, again, from my preference, Sharia supremacists. And it makes all the more dangerous something that you've touched on there. A civics lesson, I guess, folks, as I'm sure most of you know, when Congress enacts legislation, frequently it is up to various agencies of the government to promulgate regulations or fill in blanks or otherwise define what the legislators had in mind and how it will apply. You can be sure that if quite intentionally Ilhan Omar declined to define Islamophobia for the purposes of this legislation, it will be defined, whether by the State Department or whether by other branches of the executive office of the president. There will be no end of opportunities for the very people you're talking about, Robert Spencer, and warning against, and who you have struggled mightily to counter in their influence operations, namely the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists, to define it in ways that will not only include thee and me, of course, but will be very sweeping and effectively advancing the ulterior agenda of so much of this, which is to enforce Sharia in the United States, notably Sharia blasphemy. Walk us through that, if you would, quickly, Robert.
Sure. Sharia blasphemy laws forbid criticism of Islam on pain of death. The Dhimmi populations, the subjected Jews and Christians, were forbidden even to complain about their own fate and the discrimination and harassment that was directed against them, because to do so is considered to be criticism of the Quran, Muhammad, and Islam, and that would violate their contract of protection, so-called, that they had with those who were oppressing them. So it would be the same situation were this to become the law of the land, that anything that was written that or spoken that was remotely critical of Islam or perceived to be, by noting how jihad terrorists use the texts and teachings of Islam to justify violence and oppression, would be silent as a result. And so you're absolutely right. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has been working for years to bring about this exactly this kind of law under the guise of forbidding hate speech. But what it really is all about is an endeavor to impose Sharia blasphemy laws on the West.
Islamophobia is simply a fancy way to advance that agenda. And what Ilhan Omar's bill would do, I think unquestionably, is to enshrine that in law, to make it possible for the Muslim Brotherhood's influence operators to enable the various government agencies to promulgate regulations that advance this Sharia blasphemy agenda. And you mentioned the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Of course, Rashad Hussein was Barack Obama's envoy to that operation. And one of the things that's striking about the performance that he turned in during that period was captured by a moderate Muslim by the name of Azra Nomani recently in an appeal to the Senate not to confirm this man to be the ambassador at large for international religious freedom, in which he said, quote, "Mr. Hussein has protected and advanced the illiberal values of Islamic theocracies that perpetuate a disturbing and hateful ideology of Muslim supremacy," unquote. It would seem to me those are grounds for rejecting this nomination if none other were needed. Robert Spencer, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much your visiting with us and for your very clear-eyed attention to the nature of these various threats we're facing and the imperative need to be steeled against them. Among the 23 books that Robert has authored, I really want to commend, I think the most recent, The Critical Quran, Explained from Key Islamic Commentaries and Contemporary Historical Research, which not only informs us about what we're up against in the form of this Sharia supremacism, but demonstrates, if any demonstration were needed, Robert Spencer's intimate and authoritative understanding of the nature of such dangers. God bless you, my friend, and the work you do at jihadwatch.org. Keep it up. I know you will. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll take stock on this topic and much more with Sam Faddis, former Central Intelligence Agency undercover operative.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He is one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, for which I'm very proud and very grateful. His name is Charles Sam Faddis, a man of extraordinary contributions to our country, both as a public servant and as now a former public servant and patriot, very actively engaged on a number of fronts, including helping the rest of us understand what we're confronting at the moment, at a place called And Magazine. He has in his background services and Army officer, as a clandestine services officer for the Central Intelligence Agency, as an assistant U.S. Assistant Attorney General in the state of Washington, and among other things, as an author who has written a series of terrific fiction and nonfiction works, including the classic in my estimation, beyond repair, the decline and fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. In addition to finding Sam at andmagazine.com, which I hope you will do, you can find him here every week, and we're very grateful for this visit. Sam, thanks for joining us again.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you very much.
Pleasure is ours, Sam, truly. Let me ask you first about a topic that I got into some detail with Robert Spencer about, but I want to take advantage of the fact that you've spent a fair amount of your life operating behind enemy lines in Sharia supremacist nations, including, of course, Pakistan, in support of our efforts there against jihadists in neighboring Afghanistan. Talk a little bit about Sharia supremacism, Sam, for want of a better term. There are other ways to describe it, but I think that's particularly apt. And what are the implications of it for countries like ours, and most especially if we're not attentive to the ambitions of those who adhere to this doctrine?
Well, I think what people need to understand when they talk about Sharia supremacism, or, you know, jihadism, or the sort of Islamic threat that we've been confronting now for God knows how many years, is that the goal of this movement or this idea is literally world conquest, right? It is not simply, you know, people talk about various caliphates that have declared themselves at various points, ISIS being the most recent, I guess. The objective here is not simply to declare some sort of territory, a caliphate, and then provide some sort of homeland, or however you want to envision it, for jihadists. It is ultimately for the conquest of the entire planet and bringing the entire planet under this particular interpretation of Islam. And, you know, we have a tendency in the United States to sort of get, you know, we have this sort of limited attention span, and we want to continuously move on from various threats. Well, nothing has happened to make this threat go away. In fact, everything that's happened recently, most notably in Afghanistan, has made it much stronger, much more dangerous. And so I think we should expect to see that an upsurge here. I mean, from Afghanistan, the first thing I think you're going to see is that this is going to bleed over immediately into Pakistan. In fact, it's already bleeding over into Pakistan. The Pakistanis play with this idea. They think they can sort of play with fire and control it. They're about to find out what Dr. Frankenstein found out, which is you create a monster. After that, you realize it has a mind of its own, and it's going to do what it wants.
Sam, let me ask you about that, because my understanding of Pakistan's history is that it was President Zia who, during his time as the commander of the army, who really began moving Pakistan into the full-on Islamist camp and precipitating all kinds of devastation to its economy and its society in the process. Is this a case where they're not just playing with Frankenstein, they're actually responsible for being Frankenstein to some extent, and thereby having an even bigger problem as forces like the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or ISIS operate within Pakistan increasingly as well?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that there's some kind of hard wall here, because absolutely not. It's not as if you have the Pakistanis and they are fully secular in some sense, if that's the right terminology, and they have simply emboldened and played with jihadists and trained them and equipped them. That ideology permeates large portions of the Pakistani military, security forces, and intelligence forces. I mean, back in 2001, there was a case, big case, involving former Pakistani nuclear scientists and folks that had been involved with the nuclear program, in direct contact with Osama bin Laden, and well down the road toward potentially giving him an atomic bomb. And that whole thing was disrupted by the agency and under a lot of pressure by the Pakistani government, pressure from the United States. But I mean, these were top men in the Pakistani nuclear program who were 100% ideologically aligned with Osama bin Laden, meeting with him directly and well down the road to discussing how to build for him an atomic bomb. So these are guys who had spent their entire lives professionally inside the most sensitive program in Pakistan, and yet were absolutely jihadist, were 100% on board with this ideology.
And of course, Pakistan was working on behalf of and for, I would argue, communist China, which enabled the Pakistanis to get the bomb in the first place. And AQ Khan made sure that others could get it, notably the North Koreans and, I believe, the Iranians as well. Which brings me to Iran, Sam, a country that is governed by Ayatollahs who are imbued with the Sharia supremacist agenda, albeit of the Shia strain. It's not a dime's worth of difference in terms of the ultimate end state they seek, which is the triumph of Islam globally. You've written a very powerful piece at End Magazine about Iran and what this administration is doing, entitled Iran Cue the Capitulation. You start off with Bill Burns, a man that you have, I think, very helpfully raised questions about his judgment as well as his integrity, the degree to which he has been compromised by, notably, the Chinese Communist Party. Walk us through your theory of this piece and what it says to us about the dangers now emanating from an Iran that this administration seems determined to coddle and legitimate and enable.
Well, what Burns has done as head of CIA is sort of, in my view, lay out the foundation for this coming surrender, this capitulation to the Iranians, by saying in his official capacity that essentially there's no intelligence to say that the Iranians have decided to get a nuclear weapon. So it was laid out the foundation on which we can then say safely in quotes, that we can now negotiate with the Iranians and concede things to the Iranians because there's no evidence they want a bomb. That's insane. It is intellectually as dishonest as it can possibly be. I mean, there is a mountain of evidence and has been for years and years and years that the only thing the Iranians are really doing with nuclear technology is attempting to develop and field a nuclear weapon. And from the delivery systems to the testing we know they have done, I mean, there is nothing about any aspect of what they're doing that has application to nuclear power plants or other peaceful uses of nuclear energy. It is all 100% clearly focused on developing an atomic bomb, and once they have it, they already have the delivery systems, the surface-to-surface missiles, and they can reach the entire Middle East, big chunks of South Asia, big chunks of Europe, and with these space-launched weapons that they are now playing with, are within striking distance of being able, in relatively short order, probably to put a weapon into the United States. So, but also
striking distance being the operative term. I think it's fair to say.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And we, as you have intimated, I mean, look, his entire team here is basically the same guys who surrendered to the Iranians with the original Iran nuclear deal. These are all, we put the same team back out there. They surrendered to the Iranians once and gave away the store. So you don't need to guess what they're going to do. It's obvious what they're going to do. They're going to do the exact same thing they did before. They're going to capitulate to the Iranians. And, you know, the estimates vary, but literally we are potentially within weeks of the Iranians being able to have enough highly enriched uranium to construct a weapon.
Sam, are you persuaded that they have not already done so?
I don't discount the possibility at all. It is entirely possible that they already have that much material. In fact, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that they are well down the road to assembling such a weapon. I mean, people need to keep in mind that the absence of intelligence is not intelligence. The fact that we don't yet have concrete evidence, it doesn't mean that that evidence is not there, and maybe it's just simply be an issue with our collection. And when you've got the head of the Central Intelligence Agency being as blatantly dishonest as he clearly is, how much confidence can you possibly have in what our collection is or what our assessment is?
Sam, this brings me to the question that I've spoken with other guests about in recent days, which is, are the Israelis similarly uncertain about the nature of the Iranian nuclear threat? Or have they reached, do you think, a conclusion that it is very real, it is all about nuclear weapons, and it is as imminent as you say? And if the latter, do you anticipate that they are going to take action to try to, if not absolutely destroy that capability, render it unusable for the foreseeable future?
I think the Israelis have a much more sober, accurate appraisal. I think they know exactly where we are, and there's no question that they've, at this point, that they've lost any confidence in the United States, given who's sitting in the White House. So we ought to be operating under the assumption that they unilaterally may act at any time. Now, the other, not just that they will act, but then what are the repercussions of their action? Because you're probably not simply talking about like a strike that is over in relatively short order. To really disarm the Iranian, you're talking about war. And so, and the Saudis, by the way, are in the mix here too, because as you alluded to, this Sunni-Shia divide, the Saudis are not going to live in a world in which the Iranians have nuclear weapons and they don't, sitting on the other side of the Gulf. So one of the possible repercussions here is, you know, the outbreak of significant conflict in the Middle East, with a variety of countries acting against Iran without the United States and precipitating a general conflict. You know, that's one of the things that happens when we abdicate leadership, and that we're going to be sitting here watching events unfold.
Well, geopolitics, like nature, abhors a vacuum, and it is being filled, as you say. I'm going to get into this in much greater detail in our next segment with Kerry Gershonik, but just a quick assessment from you, Sam Faddis. The Middle East is one of the flashpoints that is clearly in prospectively crisis mode. We're looking at similar impending military action on the part of the Russians against Ukraine, possibly others. The Chinese against Taiwan and possibly India. And who knows what the North Koreans might do. The multi-billion dollar question, I guess, is if any one of these things kicks off in earnest, would you expect to see the other adversaries of this country, the other enemies of freedom, seize the day to try to accomplish their objectives at a moment when we and what's left of the free world will be sorely pressed to do anything about it?
Yeah, I would expect that. And I would expect it to not just necessarily be something where somebody moves and other people then decide to move as well. I would expect that you should anticipate that there will, in fact, be collusion and coordination, so that at the same that the, you know, the Russians are driving into Fort Kiev, that the Chinese are moving against Taiwan, and that the Iranians are moving in a variety of places, including Iraq, which we're getting ready to hand over to them on a silver platter. I think you could wake up any morning and find that we have adversaries all over the planet that are moving, and that we are not rolling back. And the geopolitical implications of that are staggering. I mean, I think you could find that we're in as great a danger as we were in 1941 after Pearl Harbor, where we're actually looking at losing all over the planet on a strategic basis.
And I just want to underscore that point, and then we'll let you go, Sam Faddis. All over the planet could be quite literally the case, thanks in part to this Belt and Road colonial empire build-out that the Chinese have been quietly but very aggressively pursuing. And that means in our own hemisphere, that means throughout Africa, that means, of course, the Middle East and South and East Asia as well. It will pose challenges unprecedented in our country's history, I fear. And we'll talk more about that and the implications of it with Carrie Gershonik right after this. But in the meantime, let me say thank you so much for your time today, Sam, as well as your great service to our country, which continues notably at andmagazine.com. Check it out, folks. God bless you. We'll talk with you again soon, Sam. Next up, Carrie Gershonik.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say a personal and heartfelt welcome to our next guest. He is Professor Carrie Gershonik. He's a man of great accomplishment in the uniform of the United States Marines, in which he served for 24 years as a Mustang, as they say, entered as an enlisted man, came out as a lieutenant colonel, in the course of which he served as a strategic planner and, among other things, as a spokesman in the office of the Secretary of Defense. But more importantly, as an officer with combat experience, intelligence, counterintelligence, special warfare, and strategic communications skills. He is these days a professor in Asia, most of the time, at National Chengxi University in Taiwan, and has been an adjunct professor with the University of Canberra. He is the author of two important books, in particular, of note to this conversation. One is Political Warfare, Strategies for Combating China's Plan to Win Without Fighting. And also a more recent book published, I'm pleased to say, by the Center for Security Policy Press, Media Warfare, Taiwan's Battle for the Cognitive Domain. I commend both of them to you. And I'm always happy to say thank you for doing all of that in this very distinguished career. Carrie, it's great to have you back on Secure Freedom Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Aloha, Frank, and mele kaliki maka. Merry Christmas to you and your family.
Appreciate it in whatever tongue that was. But let me talk to you, Hawaiian. Let me talk to you about what's weighing on me at the moment. You have, of course, been closely following and warning for years about the political warfare that China's engaged in. I know you are also very attentively following its increasing capacity in the other threat vectors, if you will, of unrestricted warfare, including the increasing capability of the Chinese Communist Party's People's Liberation Army. What's of greatest concern to me, honestly, is that we're not just confronting that threat or set of threats from that quarter. We're also facing a distinct possibility of conflict erupting between the Russians and the Ukrainians, the Israelis and the Iranians, who knows, the North Koreans and the South Koreans, perhaps. We're in a moment, Carrie, I think, where if any of those things eventuate, China and Taiwan, China and India, and the rest, it may be game on for all of those bad guys, giving rise to something that I think would probably be a lot like world war. Am I off the mark on that, or do you have those concerns as well?
Lose a lot of sleep over that, Frank. That's exactly the scenario that will happen. The Chinese, the Chinese Communist Party have been masters of distraction and deception since they were founded. They know to fight indirectly if they can, but if they have to fight in a frontal attack, they're going to do it while they have multiple attacks going on to distract the United States. So if they're going to, say, invade Taiwan, they're not going to do that as a single campaign, a single operation. They will have coordinated with Russia, with Putin, who again, has his eyes on the Ukraine. When you said earlier, Ukraine forces will be fighting the Russian forces. Yes, they will, but in a defensive mode, it'll be Russia that is on, in the attack mode, Russia on the offensive going in to finish the job in the Ukraine. As you point out, it's Israel fighting Iran because the Biden administration hasn't given Israel a lot of options in light of how it's cozied up significantly to Iran since it came into office. North Korea, that issue has not made a centimeter of progress since the 10 years that the current Kim and the Kim dynasty has been in power, and they become increasingly more proficient with the People's Republic of China assistance and with their nuclear capabilities. So you can rest assured, Frank, that sadly, you're absolutely correct. Anything that happens, it's going to be a multi-front war.
I was hoping you would disabuse me of this, but you've only reinforced the point.
We're not dealing with idiots. We're dealing with very smart, if evil people. So they know that they've got to cooperate. And this is their one shot. They've got about a three-year window of opportunity. And they're going to work together. They know that all cumulatively, they know this is their one big chance.
Sadly, it may not take 3 years for them to accomplish what they're seeking.
The window may close on January 20th, 2025.
Let me ask you to drill down a little bit on one facet of what you've just described, Kerry Gershonik, and that is the axis of evil, if you will, that has clearly been intensifying in terms of the strategic cooperation and presumably the actualization of the potential for collaboration in kinetic warfare between the Chinese Communist Party on the one hand and Vladimir Putin's regime in Russia. There's now been, in the past 24, 48 hours, public conversations, or at least publicized conversations between Xi Jinping and China and Vladimir Putin about, among other things, how they're going to be intensifying this cooperation, how they're going to be specifically working to take down the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, and I'm sure to further intensify their joint exercises, which are demonstrating, among other things, their potential efforts at a joint attack against the United States, including through the use of nuclear weapons. Now, whether that's something that is anything more than theater and designed, as you said in your book, Political Warfare, to win without fighting, or whether this is an ominous new evolution of the threat we face here at home, let alone in these other places we've been discussing, it remains to be seen, I guess. But what's your take on their intent and the potential of it translating into hostile action against us, just the two of them in a collaborative way?
Well, the meeting they had, as you know, Frank, that was the 37th time that Putin and Xi have met or talked to collaborate since 2013. Now, in along with that, when the two top players in the case of China, a totalitarian regime, and Putin, an authoritarian regime, when those two are collaborating at face-to-face level, when you're dealing with two countries where they're dealing with each other face to face that many times, you know that at the lower levels, at the minister level, at the operational level militarily, there's a lot more going on now than there was back in 2013. 2013, you could justify saying, those initial exercises, we can't be sure where they're heading. History says they're heading towards a much closer collaboration, but let's wait and see. It's 2021 now. And all that we feared, all that we were concerned with back in 2013 when they really began kicking off the military exercises at sea, has come to fruition. They have interoperability to some extent, but even if they fight side by side, that is a serious enough threat for our Department of Defense, for our allies within NATO and in the Indo-Pacific region to confront Russia and China fighting even side by side. But again, if they have actually developed some interoperability in combat arms, just in logistics support, that is a daunting, daunting threat. And all of that has been really on the upswing since Xi and Putin began talking. So very serious concern. The video teleconference yesterday, as you said, was more than a show of solidarity. It's psyops against the West. We know the West, to look at it from their perspective, we know we have the advantage now. And psychologically, we're going to press that advantage by showing how close we are working together, how tight our partnership is, and how much we are going to support each other in safeguarding our core interests. And as she said, safeguarding the dignity of each country. So it's a very serious issue right now, Frank.
It is indeed. And it's made the more serious, I would argue, and I think you would agree, Kerry, by what is being done to our military and its capabilities. There was an interesting development, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this as well. The public here in the United States, according to a poll last month by the Ronald Reagan Institute, has lost much of the confidence that it has traditionally reposed in our military. And that seems not entirely unwarranted by its conduct, by its leadership, by its readiness posture. And as a man who spent 24 years of his life in the uniform of the United States Marines, I'm sure this must appall you and be a further confirmation of the kinds of things you've been warning about in terms of what's befalling our military in a most dangerous time in our nation's history.
Yeah, Frank, I'm deeply concerned, as you are, being a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, with what the rot that has befallen the U.S. Department of Defense. Secretary of Defense Austin was basically blindsided by when he was presented with the results of the Reagan National Defense Survey recently, and he was confronted with it at a public forum, so he couldn't entirely gaff it off. The survey embarrassed the Austin Milley Department of Defense. And I'll go into some of the way it was mishandled as a result of that. But bottom line, let's take a look at some of the outcomes of that serious survey. Number of Americans who say they have a great deal of trust and confidence in our military has fallen 25 points, Frank, from 70% to about 45% just in the last 3 years. Now, that's before Milley and Austin came in, but what they've done, there's some egregious things that have exacerbated that fall. So it's dropped 11 points since last February, which does, that falls into their watch. Those with high trust attribute it only to our men and women in uniform. Those who lack confidence say it's the political leadership that they do not trust. And I think that's accurate, and I think that's justified for them to say that. For recruitment purposes, which I keep a close eye on, a very serious issue now. Only one third of the adults over the age of 30 have high confidence in the military. That's down 20 points since 2018.
Being the pool of people from whom you would presumably draw to have new recruits, especially
under the
very difficult circumstances.
I may have misspoke that. Under the age of 30, definitely that's your prime recruiting age group. And then we can parse that down into the different segments, 18 to 22. And you know, but bottom line is under 30, that's your recruiting pool, because isn't too far after that you have to start getting waivers to get in because of age. So now, do the American people think that we actually can win wars overseas? Mm-mm. Only about 42% of the American public now have high confidence in our ability to win a war overseas. And the confidence, the glowing confidence Americans used to have in their military is the best in the world. Well, no, not anymore. Frank, it's down to 43% of the American public thinks that the U.S. is the best military in the world. Now, 45% say we're one of the best, but that's not a good thing, because who are the other contenders? It's the People's Liberation Army. It's the Russian military. It's other forces that do not have the best wishes of the world, democracy, human rights, rule of law in mind when they start pulling triggers and dropping bombs.
That's putting it mildly.
It's not a good thing. Yes. So as far as, I can give you some other statistics.
Well, I think we've captured the key point, Kerry. Let me just ask you, because we're almost out of time. If you're an enemy of the United States, and we've enumerated several of them, and the ominous possibility that they are prepared to collaborate in a conflict with us in ways that would make vastly more challenging our defense posture and ability to contend, even with our allies, with these various simultaneous threats. Are you looking at all of this? And again, it's not just what's going on inside the military. It's going on inside our society writ large. From the vantage point of the seat of the Chinese Empire in Beijing, or the Kremlin in Russia. Were you in one of those venues, would you likely be perceiving not just a window of opportunity, but a chance to think of sort of Vladimir Putin's attachment to the fall of the Soviet Union as a animating factor in his plans and his ambitions, namely getting even, and Xi Jinping's, you know, the century in which China suffered, again, a cause for a desire to get even with the West and the United States. So
really
do you see in looking at it from
Sino-fascism, but revenge?
Yeah, looking at it from their vantage points, would this really be an irresistible temptation to strike and try to obtain their various objectives, almost certainly in concert at the moment?
Oh, absolutely. Let me use an analogy that our audience might enjoy. You're familiar with video games like fantasy basketball and fantasy football, right, Frank? So in a fantasy world, you get to pick the players of your dream sports team. Well, if you're looking at it from the Kremlin's point of view or the Politburo in Beijing's point of view, and you could select your dream team to lead your opposition, that is America's military, to strategic defeat, they would pick the Austin Milley Department of Defense right now. It is too woke. It is too unfocused on preparing the U.S. military to fight on the battlefields, the kinetic and the non-kinetic battlefields we have to fight on in the multi-domain battlefields we must fight and win on across the board here in the coming probably 2 to 3 years. And so they would pick the current team that's in office if they could pick their dream team. Not the dream team in defense of America. It's the fantasy dream team that Putin and Xi would choose to lead the forces it must defeat in combat.
And sadly, Kerry,
on an unprecedented scale and ideological and politically corrupt. And they don't seem to be ashamed of the fact. So, yeah, this is who I would choose if I was in the Kremlin or I was in the Politburo to lead the opposing team that I have to play and defeat on the battlefield.
Professor Kerry Gershenik, we have to leave it at this. Unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, folks, that dream team for our enemies is not confined to the E-ring of the Pentagon. It is operating, sadly, throughout this administration. And when you talk about incompetence or malfeasance, I think it has much more to do with the ideological corruption and the extent to which many of these folks in senior positions throughout our government are now actually compromised by these enemies. And that makes even more the case that we're dealing with a very, very tempting target, shall we say, at this particular moment in time, requiring us, among other things, folks, to redouble our efforts to promote and engage in peace through strength. Kerry Gershenik, thank you for your time today, my friend. Thank you for your contributions on so many of these fronts, including in your writings for us on Media Wars at the Center for Security Policy Press. I know you'll keep up the good work, and I trust we will talk with you often in 2022. Thank you, sir. And thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.